WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
An hour with Sam, which will include some discussion about his career and his approach to jazz piano and lots of playing. We're joined by a live audience in our music studios, and the funds for this concert broadcast are provided in part by the Philadelphia Foundation. In introducing the band before a Gershwin medley, drummer Art Blakey said of Sam Dockery, who was with the Jazz Messengers at the time, "He will do someone to watch over him. You see, he's the treasure of the band." Sam is one of the jazz pianists who appear at the Frog Piano Bar near 15th and Locust Streets in Center City, Philadelphia, where you can hear him early Friday evenings from 5:30 to 9. Before we begin this hour in Fresh Air with Sam, let me give you a rundown on his background. Sam Dockery is a resident of Camden, New Jersey, where he grew up and began his playing career. He's played with a number of other great jazz musicians over the past 25 years, including Betty Carter, Buddy Rich, Tiny Grimes, and touring and recording with Art Blakey and with Roy Haynes, with whom he's also recorded. One of the amazing things about Sam is that he didn't start playing piano until the ripe old age of 19, but he didn't waste any time and soon began attending the jam sessions which were held around Philadelphia in the early 50s with other Philadelphia-based players like John Coltrane, Ray Bryant, Jimmy Oliver, and Philly Joe Jones. In 1953, Sam Dockery began playing with Ellis Tolan, a drummer and the co-owner of Music City, an instrument shop in Philadelphia. Ellis Tolan organized Monday night jam sessions in which players passing through town at the time would attend, players like J.J. Johnson, Kay Winding, Sonny Stitt, Buddy Rich, and Lee Morgan. One night, Clifford Brown sat in, and this session was captured on tape and later released under Clifford Brown's name on a Columbia LP. The person manning the tape recorder at this session, by the way, was Philadelphia's Fred Miles, whom you might know as the publisher and distributor of Abundant Sounds. As it turned out, this was to be the last recorded work of Clifford Brown, as he and Richie Powell were killed in a car crash on the Pennsylvania Turnpike on the next day, June 26, 1956. Certainly a tragic loss to jazz. The Ellis Tolan jam sessions came at an important and fertile period for Sam, as they provided an opportunity to play with many of the greatest players of the time. Soon after, he was on the road with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, with whom he played from 1956 through 1958. In the early 60s, Sam was the house pianist at the Showboat, an important jazz club in Philadelphia, which was located near Broad and Lombard Streets in the same building which now houses the Bijou Cafe. This was another opportunity to play with a variety of the day's great jazz musicians. By 1964, Sam was back on the road with Roy Haynes. It was about this time that Sam began his formal classical piano performance and theory studies. After the stint with Roy Haynes, he came back to Camden and played occasional club dates and concerts, frequently with vocalist Evelyn Sims. Since the mid-60s, Sam has kept his base in Camden and continued his classical music studies. He started teaching piano about 5 years ago and is also a full-time student at the Philadelphia College of Performing Arts, where he studies classical piano performance, theory, and composition. Again, you can hear Sam Dockery on Friday evenings from about 5:30 to 9 at the Frog Piano Bar, located on Locust Street near 15th. Well, Sam Dockery, I guess that's your life, or part of it. Welcome, Sam, and welcome to our studio audience who is with us at our studios on Independent Small West. Shall we start with some music?
Sure. I'm going to play All the Things You Are.
All the Things You Are, okay.
Thank you.
Gee, Sam, that was really nice. I was going to plan to talk with you now, but can you play another number? We should have some.
During my era of jazz, and I started playing jazz when I first heard Bud Powell on the radio as a kid. And I also heard Charlie Parker, whose styles are so intertwined since they both came up in the same era. And two of the chord patterns or two of the musical structures that Charlie Parker and Bud Powell use as a jumping off point or chord construction or song to get warmed up by as far as jazz is concerned, and a vehicle to be very creative by was the I Got Rhythm chord changes of George Gershwin, and of course the old blues changes. And they did such phenomenal things with these.
What were the tunes that that were based on I Got Rhythm? Because there were quite a few of them that Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie wrote.
Oh, one comes to mind is Good Bait. I haven't had the opportunity to play bebop for so long. But anyway, a few songs come to mind. One is Oleo, which was composed by Sonny Rollins. And Charlie Parker would, sometimes he wouldn't play any particular theme on the I Got Rhythm changes. He would just start improvising. You know, and it's the harmonic structure of that particular song lends itself so well to improvisation. The chords resolve, you know, the chords lead from one chord to the other, so they fit so perfectly, you know, and they're so coherent until Charlie Parker could play probably all night long and never play the same thing twice on the I Got Rhythm changes. And, of course, the blues change is the same thing. And the blues changes and the I Got Rhythm changes underwent, of course, certain changes themselves when Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell played them. You know, and the strange enough, the things they did with the harmony are some of the things I was taught in school as far as harmony was concerned. And I was very happy to see that, or to find out that bebop, as it was so called, I hate that name, bebop, has such a terrible sound. But anyway, a lot of the music was drawn from classical music, from the classical harmonies, from the substitutions.
I guess a lot of the composers that were writing the songs, such as George Gershwin, also had classical background. The changes were based on for the bebop song.
True. Well, you know, George Gershwin, when he wrote, Rhapsody in Blue, he would go to Harlem to hear the jazz musicians play to get his ideas of the harmonic structure. I remember when I was studying piano with my teacher, he's dead now, I would comment, I played part of the Rhapsody in Blue very poorly. Anyway, I would comment to him how I've played some of the same things that Gershwin has in his Rhapsody in Blue for years. So he told me, well, at least he wrote it down. That was his kind of, but still, he had to hear it first. You know, it had to come from someplace. And I was amazed when I would hear certain harmony structures in the Rhapsody in Blue. I said, well, my goodness. I mean, you mean to tell me that we're both playing the same thing? You know. So Dizzy Gillespie, who I consider to be one of the foremost geniuses of this business, he's not only a trumpet player, he's a fantastic writer. And they did things with the classical harmony that I think he's still, Dizzy is still 50 years ahead of his time. He's still 75 to 100 years ahead of his time. I think the amazing thing is in college, I see the students that go to school with me now, they're just discovering Dizzy Gillespie. They're just discovering the harmonies that he wrote back in the 40s. You know, this is something that didn't just happen yesterday because I'm here playing. It's something that happened, you know, when I was quite young. And these gentlemen really don't get the credit they deserve for the kind of mind. Dizzy Gillespie had one of the most genius minds you'll ever find. Not only does he write and play trumpet, he was innovative as far as the new harmonic structure is concerned. And he adapted it to jazz. Well, I'm sorry, I'm running off at the mouth.
You know, one of the things that we should really talk about in a few moments are some of your early jam session experiences, because that was really, I guess, what could be called a baptism of fire for you in terms of your playing sense.
Yeah.
That came at a really early part of your playing career. You want to play another tune?
Yeah, I'll play another tune.
What do you have in mind?
I'll play I Got Rhythm. As such, of course, with some variance on the harmonic structure. Thank you.
You know, watching you playing, I could. It's obvious that there's a lot of thinking going on with what you're doing, and there's it's not at all rote. And it leads to a question which a lot of people ask of jazz musicians if they're really not familiar with jazz. When they look at a song printed on a piece of paper, such as Blue Monk, which might consist of a melody and some chords, and then listen to all the improvisations that are made upon that, people ask, well, did you make that up? You know, because a lot of people just aren't aware that that out of just a harmonic structure, you can pull all those improvisations. And what were you doing?
Well, first of all, the improvisation. I heard someone explain ballet a ballet artist in the same sense as they do an improvisationalist. When a ballet artist jumps up in the air, they don't exactly know what step they're gonna, you know, they're gonna come down on, what foot they're gonna come down on, or just how they're gonna do the step. Now, but I imagine through training, they have some idea of which direction they're going in. And I think it's the same thing with jazz. I think you develop, first you listen to an artist that you like. Everyone must draw from someone. No one is, I think very few people are that original that they can sit down and do something that no one else has ever done in life. So what you do, if you have a conception of the art form that you like, and you feel it very strongly, usually you have some particular artist that you like very much, and you'll have a tendency to emulate that artist that you like. But if you have any creative ability, your personality will come through. So what happens during the process of trying to be an improvisationalist or try to be creative in that particular field, you develop a train of thought, you know, which some people call a style. You can call it a style. But it's a train of thought in music. It's a train of thought harmonically that you do. I may play a line on a chord 2-5, you know, a minor chord to a major chord. Now, I may have a set line that I play to get me started, but ultimately, if I play long enough, something else will come in. I don't know where it will or just how it will happen.
Can you make a mistake?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the fun of it. You know, you're making mistakes and you get yourself out of it. Yeah. You know, and I never panic. If I make a mistake, then, I'm thinking about the next thing. The mistake is past. I'm on to something else. I never think about that.
Another thing about jazz interpretations of songs is you can have songs that will be fairly simple in the way that they're written, and you can preserve the melody so that that's still recognizable, but you can add a lot of harmonic elements.
Yes, that's true.
What's involved in that? Can you illustrate?
Well, I'll play a song called Tenderly. I'm quite sure that whoever wrote the song didn't play it the way I just got finished playing it. You know, thanks, Peter. Appreciate that. Peter also works at the Frog where I do. Very fine pianist, by the way.
We're acknowledging one of our honored guests in our studio audience.
Fine pianist. Anyway, the song itself lends itself to so many ideas harmonically. For example, I imagine there are a few people in here that play piano. Well, anyway, the first chord in the song starts on the first degree of the scale, and then it goes to the fourth degree of the scale.
Could you just play very simply, like
sure.
The first open?
I'll play a scale. All right. The first chord begins on the first degree of the scale. The second chord begins on the fourth. 1, 2, 3. Now, between the first and the fourth degree, there are passing tones, or there are tones that lead you to the fourth. For example, you know, now the tone in itself can be turned into a chord. You know, I don't want to get too involved harmonically with this. But anyway, Dizzy Gillespie and Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk was a gentleman who turned the passing tones into chords. These notes. And their approach to the different resolutions was so varied and so wide, until the gap between, I often wondered what happened to the gap between the so-called bebop era and the new avant-garde, where they seemed to disregard all diatonic structure completely. And I have a sneaking suspicion that they can't handle it too well, you know. Go ahead.
Well, you know, one thing that I'd like to talk to you about playing is what you draw upon in, like, the different harmonic elements you've just been talking about. In terms of playing solo piano, where you're the one-man band in that context.
Well,
what are the demands of solo piano playing as opposed to playing in a rhythm section with a bass player and a melody instrument?
Well, it's good if you have a hand wide enough to play tenths. You know, that helps you fill up the space. You know, that helps to make a full sound. Now, that helps if you have a wide enough hand. If you don't have a wide enough hand, I don't know what to tell you to do.
Would you be playing all that if you had a bass player with you?
No, I wouldn't. No bass player. I would play a chord in my left hand and a single note melody in my right. Inverted, of course. I wouldn't play the same note on the bottom of the chord in my left hand that the bass player would play. See, I would play an inversion of the chord. For example, if the first chord is an E-flat major chord, I would put the third in the bass. In other words, three notes up from the tonic. The bass player would play this note, I would play that. Which, I think, during the swing era, the bass player and the pianist used to play the bass lines together. And they did wonderful jobs. You know, you get the Teddy Wilsons, you get the Art Tatums. Although Art Tatum was so far ahead of his time, he would play so many inversions and passing tones until I imagine he would lose a lot of the his fellow musicians at the time that was playing with him.
Suppose a band leader comes up, because I've read about this in books, where you'll have a player who's from an older school of playing, who's the leader, who will have a more modern type piano player in his rhythm section, yeah. And he'll say, cut out all that harmony. I don't want anything that complex, like what you were playing with Tenderly in a rhythm section context. How would you simplify that? Is that in your own personal vocabulary of playing?
Yes, I could. Yeah, I could play it simple. For the simple fact of during the time when I first started playing, I associated with musicians who were older than I was. And, of course, they were from the swing era, the tail end of it, and they played tenths a lot. So my beginning harmonic structure was just the basic dominant seventh and root position, you know, whereas now it's a little different, you know, just a different texture, different color, or just altering a note here or there.
Now, if you're playing in a rhythm section, then the role of the piano is quite different than if you're playing solo.
I'm saying that I'm hesitating slightly because the role of the pianist, I'm equating the role of the pianist of today in a rhythm section with the pianist of, I'm not that old, by the way, of the pianist when I first started playing. If you listen to the old Count Basie records, you'll hear the soloist playing, and Count Basie the band is playing certain rhythmic patterns and harmonic patterns while the soloist is playing. So that was the function of the pianist in a small group rhythm section. He had to supply the rhythm along with the drummer and the harmonic structure as well. For example, the I Got Rhythm song I was playing. In other words, let's see. Well, to make it simple, the chords are now the Count Basie's band would probably do something like this. I was playing in a small group, I was expected to do that. If they didn't, it really kick me, get out of here. So when I first started playing, it was such a, I can't tell you how fortunate I was to be in that school. I acquired the knowledge of how to accompany horns, what the meaning of a pianist was in the rhythm section, to play along, to support the soloist, and also to provide the dynamic rhythm behind the soloist to build, you know, and when things get into a climax to, you know. So the era was, it was such an important learning period for me. And I had an opportunity to play with some very fine musicians, Ellis Tolan mainly one, and also around Philadelphia with Jimmy Oliver. You know, these are very fine musicians, and they took pride in playing fast and right and correct.
What were those early jam sessions like? Because there were, you had...
Oh, yeah, some of the best musicians there. John Coltrane was around then. Red Garland was there. Philly Joe Jones was there.
Well, you can conceive of a session like that, I guess, because it's really pretty historic since,
Absolutely. Since
there were so many great players around Philadelphia at that time. You could conceive of a get-together like that as being something of a party or something of a very serious, intentful event. Are any of those stereotypes...
at those jam sessions, you had two faces. You had the people that came there that really enjoyed the music, and I imagine they created the party atmosphere. Then you had the musicians who came there to learn, and they created that serious aspect.
Who'd call the tunes at the jam sessions? Was it clearly somebody was a leader?
Whoever happened to be playing. And at the jam sessions that I went to, Jimmy Oliver played mainly, and he's a fine tenor player. More people should know about him. It's a shame he never left Philadelphia. Because he's one of the finest players I've ever... And he's acknowledged all over the country. It's funny. He never left Philadelphia. He's known all over the country.
Yeah, that's the case.
Dizzy knows him. Yeah. All the best musicians know him.
How did the playing of people that did become better known, people like Ray Bryan or John Coltrane or Philly Joe Jones, how did their playing at that time compare with what they started doing, you know, maybe a few years later in the 60s or early 70s?
Yeah, that's interesting. Basically, Philly Joe Jones' playing hasn't changed. Ray Bryan's playing, I think, has changed slightly as far as harmony and solo is concerned. Although you find these felt like Ray Bryant, they were always gifted harmonically. They always played beautifully to me. And their playing was then, as now, still contemporary.
I guess what I'm asking is to borrow a phrase from, I think, an advertisement for a bread. Were those like the formative years for those players, or because you're yourself, you know, how do you look back on those years in your own playing and comparing it to what you did?
Well, I can't say for Ray Bryant and Philly Joe Jones, because those fellows played well when I first met them, and they still play well today, the ones that are alive. But it was a formative, it was a growing period for me. I was very fortunate, as you stated later, that I started playing at the age of 19. And I came to Philadelphia maybe 2 years after. And I didn't know anything about harmony. I couldn't play any melody. I didn't know anything about chords. But I could always hear them. You know, so it was a growing period for me. And I would sit under Ray Bryan. I would bug him to death. I would ask a million questions. How are you doing this? Or what do you... And a lot of times they wouldn't tell me, you know, but I'd listen. So, you know, but I was very fortunate to learn very fast. I guess because I loved it so much.
You know, it's amazing. If you started when you were 19, it was when you were, what, about 24, 25 that you were on the road with Art Blakey?
Buddy Rich, I was 24. Art Blakey 2 years later, you know, 26.
Well, you feel like playing another tune?
Sure.
Okay, now. What do you have in mind to...
Our Love Is Here to Stay. That's an old standard.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to a special live jazz broadcast with Sam Dockery, who is a New Jersey-based pianist, and he's been with us this last hour in Fresh Air discussing his work and playing some songs. Sam, time's going by much too quickly, so would you play another tune? We should take advantage of this good opportunity. Sam Dockery, the hour's gone by much too quickly. Thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It was our pleasure.
So, my pleasure.
Thank you. That's unfortunately it for today's Fresh Air. We've been listening to Sam Dockery, who you can hear at the Piano Bar, The Frog, at 15th and Locust Streets. on Friday evenings from 5:30 to 9 o'clock. Let me give you a quick clue on what's coming up tomorrow on Fresh Air. At 2 o'clock, Terry Gross will rebroadcast an interview Terry Gross had with Bobby Short. And from 3 until 5 o'clock, a tribute to Hoagy Carmichael, which was recorded last year on his 80th birthday. That'll be from 3 until 5 tomorrow. Again, thank you, a big thank you to Sam Dockery for his concert here this afternoon. Funds for this concert broadcast were provided in part by the Philadelphia Foundation. And thanks also to the studio audience, which came to hear the broadcast this afternoon. Sam, I keep playing. We got another minute left, and it's lovely. Last thank you to Sam Dockery, who's accompanying us as we're waiting to join National Public Radio for All Things Considered. Contributing today's Fresh Air was John Zwed, technical supervision by Jay Goldman and Rob Richards, and Fresh Air's production assistant is Maeve McGorn. For Terry Gross, my name is Danny Miller. Thanks very much for listening. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Twisted his arm into one more tune.
I'd like to play a Duke Ellington ballad, Lush Light.
One of my favorites. Thank you.
little shit.
Thanks.